Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Schmursday, April 4th, 2022. On the show today, news, listener questions, and in our main segment, Jim Hill talks about Love Bug Day at Disneyland to celebrate the movie Herbie the Love Bug. Let's get started by bringing in the man who says that all national anthems are really country music. It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
I am doing well, Len. Speaking of country music, you are aware of the story that if you, the Beatles album, Rubber Soul, if you play it backwards, you get the hidden message. Paul is dead. Yeah. There we go. Do you know about the hidden message if you play a country album backwards?
No.
You get your car back, you get your girl back, you get your dog back.
You get out of jail.
There we go.
That's funny.
I'm sorry, not my joke, but I always like that one.
That's great. That's funny. Yeah. All right, Jim, let's do a quick shout out to subscribers over at DisneyDish.bandcamp.com. Thanks to new subscribers Bill Devine, Steve Whedon, and Jay Byrne, and longtime subscribers Karen Pearsall, Ken Ballard, and Carl Gutag. Jim, these are the folks responsible for feeding all the guests that show up for the Hoop-Dee-Doo review over at Fort Wilderness. They say that frying 900 pounds of chicken is the hard part, because now they're using the old Fort Wilderness Railroad to mash the 400 pounds of potatoes they serve every night. True story.
I thought I got a hint of diesel in there.
Just a touch of locomotive in with the spuds.
Just a soupçon, you know, just sort of like, so, okay.
Hint of axle grease here? What is this? This is tasty.
There we go.
All right, folks, let's do the news. The Disney Dish News is brought to you by Storybook Destinations, trusted travel partner of the Disney Dish Podcast. For a worry-free travel experience every time, book online at storybookdestinations.com. So a couple of quick reminders. We're doing our first ever Disney Dish cruise, September 23rd to the 26th of this year. I believe that is sold out, but check storybookdestinations.com/Disney Dish to be sure. Also, Jim, you and I are doing the second annual Gingerbread Challenge in Walt Disney World. It's Friday, December 2nd, and that weekend we have a couple of really interesting events lined up there, including a private thing at La Cava. More details on that shortly. And then we're still looking at March 30th to April 1st of 2023 for a group cruise on the Star Cruiser Halcyon. So that's a Thursday check-in and a Saturday check-out, so almost exactly 1 year from today. And again, we're checking out somehow appropriately on April Fool's Day. And speaking of events, Jim, it looks like there's a Walt Disney World media event planned for May 4th through the 6th of 2022. This has got to be for Guardians of the Galaxy, right?
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Supposedly, they are still locked in on the official Memorial Day opening. Mm-hmm. So, looks like the weeks directly following the press event will be previews. Annual pass holders, yeah. Previews, DVC, cast member previews, yeah. That sort of stuff. So.
Yeah. So, I heard cast members may or may not come before the press event. So May 4th, 5th, and 6th is the press event. I know that they've invited large market media, small market media, and travel agencies already. I think May 7th will be another preview event for some other lucky Walt Disney World folks. And then I think after that, it'll be DVC, APs, and stuff like that.
Makes sense.
Also, while we're at Epcot, it looks like cultural representatives are returning to Epcot later this summer. That is definitely good news.
Yeah.
You want your croissants handed to you by people who speak French natively? It makes them taste better. That's my opinion anyway.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's true. Also, Jim, did you see that Disney added a disclaimer to Genie Plus purchases saying, quote, on average, guests can enter 2 to 3 attractions or experiences per day using the Lightning Lane entrance if the first selection is made early in the day. So we have now in writing that this is just paid Fastpass, right?
Yeah. And you know that last parenthetical there gave the first selection made early in the day.
Yeah.
How many people bought into the Genie Plus system, assuming they'd be able to waltz right into things? And it did not work out that way, which led to some rather loud, angry conversation to guest relations. So,
yeah, my guess is this is either guest relations saying, for the love of God, please let people know what can they expect. Or it's the legal team saying, hey, you know what may be a great idea here?
Yeah. You of all people know that, you know, the problem with so many of the Disney attractions is they will, over the course of the day, you know, it's a 101. It's a, you know, something goes.
Oh, you mentioned this. Yes. So I've been doing some analysis, Jim.
Okay.
Yeah. So one of the problems with Genie Plus and with Individual Lightning Lane, especially mm-hmm. at Epcot, is that the rides are so unreliable that it's causing backups, not only on those attractions which are involved in Genie Plus and Individual Lightning Lane, but of course there's a cascading effect because once a ride goes down, people go somewhere else, right? So just, mm-hmm. just to give you an example, I've looked at downtime per day over the last couple of weeks in minutes for some of the major attractions in Epcot and then around the park. And this is one of the reasons why I did that. So Remy's Ratatouille Adventure, which opened last year in Epcot, is averaging, Jim, an hour and a half of downtime per day.
Ooh,
so you think about that. I mean, the park's open for 12 hours, right?
Right.
And 90 minutes of it are spent offline, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's 13% of the day is just offline. And the problem with that is, you know, once Remy's offline, people will walk to the next closest kid-friendly ride in World Showcase, which is Frozen Ever After. But that's not great because while Remy is down 90 minutes, 91 minutes a day, Frozen Ever After is down 82 minutes a day.
Okay. Right?
What do you do? Right?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
In contrast, this makes Test Track, which is only down, Jim, 58 mm-hmm. minutes a day on average, look like the most reliable thing in the park.
Wow. Okay.
But the winner, Jim, the winner across the parks mm-hmm. has to be the studios, where Rise of the Resistance is averaging, Jim, not this is not the max, averages mm-hmm. an hour and 47 minutes a day of downtime. Over the last 2 weeks, nearly 2 hours of downtime a day for Rise of the Resistance. And that's on top of Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway, which averages 45 mm-hmm. minutes a day almost in terms of downtime. So between those two rides, mm-hmm. you're looking at just under 150 minutes, 2.5 mm-hmm. hours a day of downtime in just those two rides.
Remy, Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway, and likewise Rise of the Resistance are those trackless rides.
Yeah.
Which can get weirdly glitchy.
But they're also big budget things. I mean, yeah. I mean, not for nothing, but Disney spent $1 billion on Galaxy's Edge.
They did.
$1 billion should buy you a ride that is not down 13% of the day.
Yeah, well.
Same thing with Remy. I mean, Remy's a clone. Why is it down an hour and a half a day?
That's hard to explain when you think about Rise of the Resistance, where you have so many moving parts. Whereas
Rise of the Resistance, like I can squint my eyes and accept Rise of the Resistance. It's the best ride they've done in decades. It is, mm-hmm. to your point, insanely complicated. Like I could accept that if I had to, right? But mm-hmm. with everything else, like if that was the one ride. And you'd be like, well, you know, mm-hmm. yes, my husband doesn't have teeth or anything, but I love him anyway. And he listens to mm-hmm. terrible music, but he's still my husband, right? I'm mm-hmm. I'm there with that, right?
Okay.
But geez, I don't know, man. That's a lot of downtime.
You're not wrong.
And the reason, Jim, why I mentioned this is thanks to our friends in Walt Disney Activation Earring, because mm-hmm. I'm going to stop calling them Imagineers now. But thanks to our friends in Walt Disney Activation Earring, mm-hmm. we now have some idea of the testing schedule for Guardians of the Galaxy and how well it's doing. So it looks like, and this is interesting, one of the things I had looked at prior to this mm-hmm. was if you follow certain members of Activation Earring on social media, you can figure out pretty much the testing schedule for Guardians of the Galaxy by looking at where these people are when they post on social media. So it turns out, and this is just a guess, I could be wrong. It looks like they don't test Guardians of the Galaxy on Fridays. So, and by testing, I mean like they're running the ride all day, simulating as if people were actually on the ride. Because at this point, they should be doing that. You know, this is the burn-in period. Mm-hmm. Right? But it looks like Fridays is the date on which they don't do the testing. It looks like on Saturday. So it looks like Friday, they actually do whatever adjustments they need to be doing. And then mm-hmm. on Saturday, they come in and test whatever changes they made on Friday. And I note that because the downtime that mm-hmm. we're seeing on Saturdays is significantly higher. So if you look at the downtime and you exclude the Saturdays on which mm-hmm. I guess Disney's testing all of the stuff that they made changes to on the Friday, right? Mm-hmm. It turns out that Guardians of the Galaxy right now is actually more reliable than Rise of the Resistance and almost as reliable as Remy's Ratatouille Adventure. And the reason why I was interested in this is because I asked our friends at Walt Disney Activation Earring mm-hmm. Whether Guardians would open with boarding groups. And so a couple of people passed on this particular piece of information and said, what do you think? And so my
wow. Okay.
You know, and so my guess is at this point it probably will, at least for a couple of weeks, open up with boarding groups, because it's averaging just over 90-ish minutes a day of downtime, again excluding all of the days in which it the test and adjust happens. So yeah, I think it'll open, but I'd be surprised if it doesn't go to individual lightning lane right after that. Mm-hmm. Some other interesting news I learned from our friends over at Activation Earring. Did you know, Jim, that, well, you know, of course, that there are two parts to Princess Fairy Tale Hall at the Magic Kingdom, right? There's princess greetings on either side of Princess Fairy Tale Hall, right? Mm-hmm. Did you know internally that they refer to one side as the blue side and the other side as the pink side?
Isn't that supposed to be tied to the whole make it blue, make it pink thing from Sleeping Beauty?
No idea. No idea what you're talking about there, Jim.
Okay.
Is that really what it is?
I want to say it's a Flora and a Meriwether fight over what color Princess Aurora's dress should be. The make it blue, make it pink, make it blue, make it pink.
Oh, that makes way more sense. Because my question back to our friends at Activation Earring was, okay, who's blue and who's pink?
There we go.
So we'll hopefully we'll have this mystery cleared up by the next show, and then we'll reveal the answer then.
Okay.
Finally, Jim, it looks like the new ice cream place Salt and Straw is looking to open shortly in Disney Springs. Our friend of the podcast, Jonathan Rubenstein, wrote in last week to say that he has now sampled some new Salt and Straw flavors and that Walt Disney World is in for a real treat. So I am super excited to see this happen. That should be like anytime in the next couple of weeks.
Cool, cool. Any idea where Salt and Straw is going in
Disney
Springs?
I believe it's on the west side over by in the Haleo area.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay. Cool, cool.
Yeah, super excited for that. All right, Jim, we got a bunch of surveys from people, so I want to go over those and also some listener questions if we have time. I'm going to save the long survey for later. Let's start with this one. So our friend Andrea got a Genie Plus survey from Walt Disney World, and she writes in and says, I rated it as poor, and then it asked me to choose reasons why we rated Genie Plus poor, and the list seemed very reflective of feedback they've already received. It was an extensive list of reasons not to like Genie Plus, all of which were true. And I love that line.
Oh.
like, you know, I can agree. Yeah, here's a list of all the things that Disney said people don't like about Genie. And yeah, I can agree with all of them. It's fantastic.
Oh, wow.
Things like not enough inventory, technical glitches in the app. I couldn't plan ahead what I wanted to do with my day. And I had to keep checking my phone throughout the day. Plus, too expensive. It also asked whether I planned to use Genie Plus in an individual lightning lane on future visits. So it looks like Disney's hearing the feedback, Jim. They're trying to figure out now, I guess, how to do damage control on it.
Yeah. What's been fascinating just this past 3 weeks or so is Disney's battles with the state of Florida. But
we're going to talk about that next week, but yeah.
Virtually every article, in addition to talking about, you know, Mr. Chapek tussling with Governor DeSantis.
Disgruntled customers.
Yes, works in a mention of to the effect of, you know, rising prices at the parks, new admission materials. And it's just sort of like Disney can't escape this story.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, it's like the White Star Line when they launched the next ship after the Titanic, and the press release was like, "Yeah, but remember the time? But what about?"
Yeah.
Like, no, we're not talking about that anymore. We're onto the new thing.
There we go. Yeah.
All right. Our friend Nicholas sent in a Disneyland Magic Key survey, and Jim, I want to get your input on this one question that I haven't seen before, and I want your take on what the possible meaning might be for it.
Okay.
So Nicholas's survey included this question. If the Magic Key program had not been an available option, how many times would you visit the Disneyland Resort over the course of a year? If you're unsure, please enter your best guess. So there's a two-parter here. How many trips would you take and the number of days per trip? So why would they want to know whether you'd still come to Disneyland? And if so, how often and for how many days?
You remember, they had this previous pattern established to the effect of they wanted the locals to come twice a year. They wanted them to come during the summer, and they wanted them to come during the holiday period.
Yep.
And now with all of this annual passholder program coupled with the fact that you need reservations to get into the park and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
That's broken.
Yeah, because you can't make reservations, right? There's some days, and we've seen the lawsuits, right? There's some days where you just can't get in, even if you've got the non-blackout date ticket.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people at Disneyland who are like, don't panic. You know, remember, we're still coming out of the pandemic. We're still ramping up. But I'm told retail is off. Food sales are off. A lot of the revenue streams that the company had always counted on aren't where they're supposed to be. And the problem is you can't point to the pandemic anymore.
Well, no doubts. Yeah. Were you the one that told me, because you mentioned the food sales, were you the one that told me that kitchen cook staffing is at 40% of pre-pandemic levels?
If that.
Yeah. And do you see that Disney's offering now, like, was it $4,000 signing bonuses if you can boil water? Like, honest to God, like if I was coming out of school right now, I would do a 6-month culinary career and just take the bonus.
It's such a strange situation because Disney finds itself competing against Amazon.
Yeah, for bus drivers, yeah, and for things like that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just one of these things where it's like the forces in the marketplace have changed so dramatically just over the last 2 and 3 years that Disney is genuinely struggling to, you know, what's it going to take to get people to come through the door? And, I mean, this is another reason why you're seeing – increasing leaning toward automation, or can we put that in an app? Because that means we don't have to hire a person or persons.
Yeah. Cooking food, though, isn't going to be automated anytime soon. And that's by itself is it not only a huge investment, but it kind of restricts the number of things that you can cook. Right.
Well,
because you and I could figure out how to cook a hamburger after learning how to cook an omelet, but to teach a robot to do that is decidedly more difficult.
I agree. But not to say that there aren't people out there trying that very same thing.
You know? Yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. By the way, did you see Universal just raised its entry-level wages for cast members to up to $20 an hour?
That tells you quite a bit about the Orlando job market.
All right. Before we do the last survey, a couple of quick listener questions. This is one from the fabulous Mrs. Shannon Ford. By the way, you should check out her YouTube channel. That's Shannon Ford. And Shannon writes in with this. My family and I typically travel to Walt Disney World the first week of December, so 12/4 to 12/11 this year. However, my son is now in school, so that means taking him out for a week. We noticed that this upcoming school year, his winter break includes the first week of January. So we're thinking about moving our trip to January 1st to January 8th instead. I know the beginning of January tends to be slower. However, because other school districts may have a similar schedule, I'm thinking that may not be the case in 2023. The touring plan's crowd calendar shows mostly sevens in January. I know the tail end of the week is the marathon, but do you have any thoughts? Yeah, so this is interesting because January 1st is a Sunday. So the legal holiday in 2023 will be January 2nd, which is the Monday. But then Orange County schools also have off January 3rd as a teacher workday. So that means the only day that week where there's not either a school holiday or a marathon is January 4th, but that's the day probably everyone's flying in for the marathon.
There you go.
And then you've got that. So yeah, I think it's going to be fairly busy. The only thing really we don't know this far out is about how the flu or COVID numbers are going to look, you know, next winter. And that'd be my only big concern right now. But assuming, you know, things stay as good as they are now, yeah, I would expect that first week of January to be much busier than average.
No. Sorry, Shannon. You know, that's, them's the breaks.
Have you thought about truancy?
There we go.
Exactly. All right. Here's one from Dan Heaton. Great job on the latest episode on the modern classics from Disney. Len mentioned Agent P's World Showcase Adventure, which was actually the second iteration of that interactive game in World Showcase. Yes, Dan, you, Pat O'Day, and approximately 11 billion other people pointed that out. The first was Kim Possible, which really changed the landscape. I'm running because I thought you might be interested in the podcast interview that I just released with Jonathan Ackley, the creator of those experiences, plus Sorcerers of the Magic Kingdom, the Minnehune Adventure Trail over in Aulani, and the Play Disney Parks app and a Pirate's Adventure. So that's tomorrowsociety.com/Jonathan-Ackley-podcast if you're interested. Dan's great. I've done his podcast a few times, and every time Dan sends out a list of questions he's going to ask, it feels like a graduate school syllabus. Like, because he'll ask you, like, hey, we want to talk about, like, your five favorite Disney theme park books. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like picking your five favorite children. Mm-hmm. And so I had to go back and reread the books and then figure out like, do a critical analysis on them and figure out like why I like these books versus, you know, whatever was sixth on my list and wasn't going to get mentioned. And I ended up doing like 7 pages of notes on 5 books. And it went by in like an hour and a half.
But again, I appreciate you do your homework.
Yeah, yeah. No, Dan does a very good detailed podcast. You should go listen. Tomorrowsociety.com. Mm-hmm. All right. Also, same thing from Tom Barnes. I'm not sure which of the Disney modern classics I'd remove from your list to make room for my favorite ride, but it should get an honorable mention. The ride I'm referring to is Toy Story Midway Mania. From the over-the-top queue to the actual ride and game, it's an absolute classic of the modern era. It makes great use of the screens and 3D glasses, even some 4D effects if you count the air in your face. It's very rewritable, especially since it's a competition, and it's fun for the whole family. While there are a lot of great attractions at Hollywood Studios, this is the one must-do ride for me. Mm-hmm. So I consider this on my list, Jim. What about you?
I was going to use it to talk about how I've noticed that lately the Imagineers do this thing where they have one really great AA figure in an attraction, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Like the Navi River Adventure or Expedition Everest when the Yeti was working.
Summer of the Yeti.
Summer of the Yeti. There we go. Toy Story Midway Mania has Mr. Potato Head, which, you know, I love.
Yeah.
I guess part of the problem for me is that I find that the competition aspect of the attraction actually pulls me out of the ride. I am suddenly so competitive with who I'm traveling with. It's kind of like Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger Spin. You know, you're not enjoying the environment. You're looking for little X's to hit with your laser. But he's not wrong about the rewritability.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. The thing that I always remember about Toy Story Midway Mania is going on it with my family because, mm-hmm. like, I'm competitive. I'll tell people that. My twin sister, Linda, is the most competitive person I've ever met. She's the one who once coined the like, we were, one time we were in Epcot, like we were younger, and it was pouring down rain. And we're like, I don't know if we should we go home or whatever? And she looked at me with like dead eyes and said, rain calls the weak from the herd. All right.
Wow.
Linda's on a different level than the rest of us. So that's why I can't go on these rides with her, right? Because we'd be slapping each other. Like as soon as your hand goes towards like the spinning thing, the spinning lever on Buzz Lightyear, the other person will just slap it. You know, and then you come out and you're all, it's not a family bonding moment for us. But okay, I see your point. It is a great ride, Tom. It's definitely my top 10. Okay. I don't know that I would put it fifth, but yeah. Hmm. All right. So here's another email from Pat O'Day. And again, approximately 11 billion other people. I can't believe neither of you had Radiator Springs Racers on your list. I'm a gigantic Star Wars fan, so it speaks volume about the quality of Radiator Springs that I put it above Rise of the Resistance. It's the most fun I think I've ever had on a Disney attraction. You know, I somebody wrote this exact thing to me on Twitter, and I responded with Radiator Springs Racers, you mean West Track?
If you think about it, both you and I didn't mention Cars Land or, for that matter, Pandora. And I think in both of those cases, you can't really separate the attraction from the land.
Yeah. For me, in the case of Pandora, it's the movie as well.
Oh, true, true. But it's just, I guess in my mind, I was thinking about using the yardstick of individual standalone attractions versus, well, you know, it's not almost not fair to mention Cars Land or Pandora because they're so all-encompassing. They're so next level that, but again, you know, Paige isn't wrong, or excuse me, Pat, that we should imagine these.
That would probably be number 6 on my list. And to your point, it's not just Radiator Springs Racers, which, well, it does have elements of Test Track in it. It is such a novel implementation of it that it is unique. But the thing I love about that is, and you're right, it's the entire land. Whether it's the view you get from Flo's V8 Cafe with its classic mid-century modern architecture, or the fact that they just decided to build like a 4 or 5 story backdrop and reproduce a canyon, you know, in it. That's just classic Imagineering. Yeah,
absolutely.
Also, Pat had two great stories about riding Soarin' and seeing Festival of Lion King in Walt Disney World. After taking some edibles to help with anxiety, I would read those stories on the air, Jim, but I'm writing them into a script for Netflix. So, yeah, there are some stories.
Okay.
All right. Last question from Paige, who says, hello, my fiance and I are looking to book a Disney trip in the next year or so. I'm a lifelong Disney person, and he has never been. Is this counseling advice at this point? We'll see. Okay. I qualify for the DAS, the Disability Access Service, and I was wondering if there's any reason to get Genie Plus if I already have DAS. I assume preferred seating would be a perk and maybe it'd be easier in terms of planning. Any advice is appreciated. All right. So I actually posed this question to some folks on the Touring Plans forums and chat. More people don't use both than do use both. Page. And the main reason for not doing both that they give are this. One, I don't want to crisscross the park that much. And then two, it's a lot of time on the phone. So going back to the earlier survey we said about not using Genie Plus because it takes all your time on the phone is definitely a thing for DAS as well here. But there are people, Page, who typically do use both. And their strategy is this. Use DAS on attractions for which the Genie Plus or individual Lightning Lane is gone for the day or where the return time is very far ahead of the day. So if you walk into the studios at 10 a.m. and the return time for Rise of the Resistance is already 7 p.m., you're better off using DAS for that, right? Then the flip side of that coin is to use Genie Plus on attractions with a much closer return time. And that's how you would use both of them in conjunction with each other.
Makes sense. Okay.
All right, one last thing, an email from Ken. And Jim, this has to go in the I can't even, I have no more evens category. Here's an email from the Walt Disney Company that misspells the words Disney World. And Jim, you see the email there. This is a theme park reservation confirmation email where Disney World is one word with the lowercase w in world.
Okay.
I how does this get past QA? How? All right, then.
Okay.
All right. Well, there's that. All right, Jim. So the last thing I want to talk about here, and it's sort of extensive, is Universal Orlando has been sending out a series of surveys asking people about pricing options for Universal's Epic Universe theme park. And so so thanks to Jonathan for sending in an example of this survey, and also Danielle, because they both got the same survey, but with different prices. And that's what I wanted to go over with you.
Oh, okay.
All right. So the first question, the setup here is, imagine that you're visiting the Orlando theme parks after Epic Universe, Universal's newest theme park, opens. Mm-hmm. Epic Universe will open in the next few years. What time of year would you be most likely to visit a theme park? And then it gives, around Christmas or New Year's Day, mid-January to early March, spring break or Easter, the basics of the schedule.
Okay.
The next question is, how many days would you spend visiting the theme parks in that time period? Mm-hmm. And so Jonathan here answered 5. The next question is, if you're going to spend 5 days visiting the theme parks that month, how many days would you most likely spend at each of these attractions? Give us your best guess. So how many days would you spend at Walt Disney World? 0 days, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days or more. Mm-hmm. And for this particular one, Jonathan put 0. How many days would you spend at SeaWorld? The answer was 1. And then how many days would you spend at Universal Orlando? 4 days. Mm-hmm. And there's a follow-up question on that saying, okay, you've said you would spend 4 days at Universal Orlando. How many days would you spend at each of Universal's parks? So how many days would you spend at IOA? How many days would you spend at Universal Studios Florida? How many days would you spend at Volcano Bay? How many days would you spend at Epic Universe? Mm-hmm. And so for this particular question, Jonathan answered that he would spend no days at Volcano Bay. I think he's going over Christmas, so that kind of explains why for weather. He'd spend 1 day at IOA, 1 day at Universal Studios Florida, and then 3 or more days at Epic Universe. So I think Jonathan here is definitely the demographic that Universal wants for this kind of survey. Mm-hmm. And then the next question, there are 12 screens on this one, but it asks how you feel about different price options. And this is really interesting because of the way the questions are structured. And I'll give you an example, Jim. First question, screen number 1 of 12 says, if these were the only Universal Orlando resort tickets available, which one would you choose? And there are four options. Option number one, the simple one is, I don't like any of them and I wouldn't go to Universal, right? So we'll just ignore that.
Okay.
If we ignore that, then there's three options per screen. All right. Okay. So the first option is you can go to Universal Studios, you can go to Islands of Adventure, or you can go to Epic Universe. And that's park hopping, right? So access more than one park per day. You can throw on an additional visit to Volcano Bay for $70. But your ticket is only good for one afternoon after 4 p.m. Would you pay $120.99 to get into those three parks after 4 o'clock and park hop? All right, that's one option.
Okay.
The second option on the screen is Universal Studios Florida, Islands of Adventure, Epic Universe, Volcano Bay for $85, and one full day plus one afternoon after 4 p.m. for $428.99, right? So if you look at that, right, if you just subtract the second option, or the first option from the second option, the question is would you pay $308 for one day of park hopping between the three parks? That seems like a lot of money.
That does. That does.
The third option would be 5 days just at Epic Universe with an additional day at Volcano Bay for $70, but the 5 days at Epic Universe cost $300. So let's put that in comparison. You could do an afternoon at three parks for $121. You could do 5 days at Epic Universe for $300. Or for $129 more, you could visit Universal Studios and Islands of Adventure for one additional day.
I know we have a few more screens to get through here, but I wonder if the whole notion of, you know, would you visit it in the afternoon?
Yeah.
Remember, this is the park that's going to be built next to the Orange County Convention Center, and we've already been told that one of the more intriguing features of this park will be the fact that the lands will be designed in such a way off of the hub that they can be literally closed off. One land will shut down.
For corporate events, yeah.
There you go.
You were the first person to mention this, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and depending on, you know, whether there's one giant convention in town or several smallish conventions, but would still want to avail themselves of the opportunity to have a line, you know, a land open for either a breakfast event or say, close it off in the late afternoon for a party in the evening, I think Universal recognizes going into Epic Universe, their pricing is going to have to be that much more dynamic to reflect the, oh, hey, I know you wanted to go into the Universal Monsters land, but that's closing it for today. So I don't think you should necessarily pay full price. But here, let's go with our sliding scale, so to speak.
I definitely think that's it. By the way, the I love the idea that Universal can close off an entire land for a corporate event. And I think this is something that we saw hinted at Volcano Bay, where access to certain water slides happens through, you know, one of its themed areas. And they could do the same thing there. So, you know, you could basically buy a slide for a night. The other thing, so two other things I thought were interesting. I previewed this to some of our friends who know Universal better than I do. So Joseph Matt was one of them. And he pointed out this afternoon option might be Universal's attempt to steal an afternoon away from Disney for people who are arriving like midday. Right? So for $49, and I'm just making up a number here, $49 to go check out a Universal theme park, the day that you show up, people might take that. You know?
Yeah, that's not a bad idea at all. The whole notion is going for an incremental approach, but if enough people go for the incremental, that could be a significant pile of change.
So for any of our listeners who, who've got this survey, if you could send me the screens, I'd appreciate it, because I'm compiling a master spreadsheet of all the different pricing options. And one of our listeners, Adam, actually correctly identified that this is something called conjoint analysis, where the he says the objective is to identify exactly which product features matter most to your customers. So Adam pointed out that in his previous life, he did it with food products. So if you're looking about at food products and, like, you know, one of them is low salt and one of them is low calorie and one of them is low, you know, or has expanded flavor, you know, stuff like that, or, you know, non-GMO versus GMO, you could actually test different combinations and different price points of those features to see which things mattered the most to people.
Interesting.
So here's the interesting thing. If I compiled all of the results into, like I said, into a survey. So looking at just the pricing options for Epic Universe among the surveys that we've seen, the pricing for one afternoon at Epic Universe is varying between $140 and $146, which that's not a huge range. But the more interesting thing for me would be the price ranges for a five-day ticket, which varies. One survey I saw was at $300 for 5 days. Another one was at $355 for the same 5 days. So another, that's $56 more, right? Yeah. Or $55 more. And then another one was at $610. So $300, $355, and $610 for 5 days.
That is quite the range. Wow.
And then, there are a couple of other interesting ranges too. So for like just Universal Studios Florida, the price ranges for 5 days were $592 or $610. If you wanted 1 day and one afternoon, the price options for all three theme parks, but not Volcano Bay, so Universal Studios Florida, Islands of Adventure, and Epic Universe, if you wanted 1 day and one afternoon where you could hop between the parks, the price options ranged from $205 to $429. I don't know that they could get $429 for 1 day and one afternoon.
No.
And this is one of those things where I was thinking, like, are they putting that $429 in just to make everything else look better?
That's possible. I get that Epic Universe, everything we've heard is, you know, this is the next level park.
Yeah.
We were just talking early in the show about lands like Pandora and Cars Land, or to a lesser extent, Galaxy's Edge. This is supposedly Universal throwing down the gauntlet for what it will do in this very same space. So that set of pricing is very confident.
It's very aggressive for what it is. Yeah.
People who come into town for conventions, they typically aren't spending their money. They're spending the company's money. And so that's what supports all of those overpriced restaurants along iDrive.
Yeah, that's true.
I wonder if that's also something that Universal is kicking the tires of, that given the proximity to the convention center, that we can get away with ramping up pricing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why we saw the option, these new ticket options. So there's an option for a 1 day and a one afternoon ticket. So if you've got a convention from like, you know, Monday through Friday, you might stay Saturday to go to the theme parks.
I agree.
And, you know, and conventions will end, you know, Friday, early on Friday. So people can go home or whatever. So that would give you the afternoon and the one full day. Mm-hmm. But the other interesting option that was in the surveys is just the afternoon tickets. Mm-hmm. And the pricing on these things was all over the place. So like the least expensive afternoon option that I saw was $70 to get into either IOA, Epic Universe, or Volcano Bay. Mm-hmm. $70 for an afternoon. And that seems fair, like for after 4 o'clock. But the most expensive option was $287 to get into IOA and Volcano Bay with park hopping for an afternoon.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's nearly $300.
Yeah.
For an afternoon. That seems pricey. Yeah. So $70 to $287. Were the options there. Most of them were in the $120 to $160 range with park hopping for afternoon. So it'll be very interesting to see where Universal goes from here with this.
Love that we have this information this early out.
Yeah, and I'm definitely going to do the analysis to see what's going on there.
Cool.
Like I said, if you get a copy of the survey, please send it in so I can update our spreadsheet.
Appreciate that.
And we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, Jim gives us the history of Disneyland's Love Bug Day, which happened back in 1969. All right, Jim, we've talked about the Yippies in Disneyland. We've talked about a lot of historical events that have happened at Disneyland. We have never talked about Love Bug Day. And I'm assuming here you are talking about the creatures that that frequent Central Florida in the spring and in the fall.
Oh, don't you love scraping those off of your windshield? This is different and kind of ties into Walt Disney himself and his take on his company. People have talked in the past about the whole Walt once saying, you can't top Pigs with Pigs, which people have interpreted as, you know, Walt didn't like sequels. And that's not true. In Walt's own lifetime, the studio produced at least two sets of sequels, The Absent Mind Professor in March of 61 and Son of Flubber in January of 63. Likewise, The Adventures of Merlin or Misadventures of Merlin Jones in March of 64. And then its sequel, The Monkey's Uncle, which was released in August of 65. I mean, Walt was an innovator and a storyteller, but at the same time in the 1960s, he was a practical businessman who was on the lookout for additional revenue streams. After all, he had his family fun park in Anaheim that he was expanding. Likewise, during that period, he was funneling money to acquire land for Project Sunshine, what eventually became Walt Disney World. And so when Walt detected a pattern, noticed that a certain film the studio did well, he paid attention to it. So, for example, when Old Yeller came out in December of 57 and did big business, it's like Walt took note of that. And then when The Shaggy Dog came out in March of 59 and did even bigger business, Walt said, okay, that's a thing. People like Disney-produced movies about dogs. So he turns to his literary acquisition department and tells him, go snatch up the movie rights to a bunch of books about dogs. Seriously, Len, over the next 5 years, we got Nicky the Wild Dog of the North, we got Greyfarer's Bobby, we got Big Red, Savage Sam, The Incredible Journey, and Ugly Dachshund. That's just in one window of time between July of 61 and February of 66. And Walt was really practical about this. So like, look, I can send this out into theaters, and then a year and a half, 2 years later, I can change these movies into two-part episodes that they show on my TV show on NBC. You know, it all works out. So, you know, with the idea of Walt paying very close attention to what does the business, Absent Minded Professor comes out in 61. And and Walt takes a step back and it's like, okay, so what does that mean? Does that mean people like Fred McMurray movies, or do they like movies where cars fly? And so Walt kind of splits the bet. He does a bunch of movies with Fred McMurray. He does like Bon Voyage, Son of Flubber, Follow Me Boys, and Happiest Millionaire. And given that of those four, three of them underperformed at the box office, it's like, okay, clearly Fred McMurray is not the movie star that I thought he was. On the other hand, Son of Flubber does business, and it has the flying car again. It's like, okay, let's buy some car stuff. So he has the studio acquire the film rights to Upton Sinclair's The Gnome Mobile, a novel from 36 that they then turn into a movie, goes out in 67.
So you said Upton Sinclair. I'm like, how is The Jungle going to be a theme park ride?
There we go!
Fall into a vat made into sausages. Yeah, you know, this could be a month. There could be a Monsters Inc. tie-in in there. I think. Let's workshop this. That's not a bad idea. All right.
Okay, I am not opening that can, Len.
That can of worms.
There we go. Sorry, had to do it. Had to do it.
That was beautiful.
Anyway. Okay, so Walt tells us we need car stuff. And so one of the things that comes in over the transom, I mean, it's not a script, it's not a book, it's more of a treatment for a film by Gordon Buford. It's called Car, Boy, Girl. Buford bases it on, you know, he grew up on a farm in Colorado, and he talked about how, you know, his parents had this constant battle with the family car. And how sometimes it would start, sometimes it wouldn't start, but it seemed to literally be the whim of the car. And so he talked about his mom would sit inside the car and gently try to persuade it, and the father would curse at it. And it still, sometimes it would take them into town, and sometimes it wouldn't. And he remembered how his mother, for example, would hold her breath as she put her foot down on the starter as if she was really gentle, the car would start. And so, you know, and Walt reads through all this stuff and sees, okay, a stubborn little car, mind of its own. Mm-hmm. And it brings a couple together. It's okay, we can maybe do something with this.
And everyone relates to it, right?
Well, that's
it's
the
like
thing.
The dog in the car. Everyone relates to having dogs and having cars.
Yeah. So Walt options this property in 61, same window of time as Absent-Minded Professor. But he passes away in December of 66, and Car, Boy, Girl sits in a slush pile of scripts on Walt's desks as, you know, the employees mourn and the company tries to figure out how it goes forward without its founder. But luckily, Walt leaves behind a cadre of loyal creative lieutenants, and among them is Bill Walsh. And Bill is the producer of Disney hits like Shaggy Dog, Absent-Minded Professor, Son of Flubber, and more importantly, the studio's biggest earner to date, Mary Poppins. Mm-hmm. There are so many great stories associated with Bill because he is so matter-of-fact. There's an interview he did, for example, in 1970, where he talked about, look, I make movies for people between the ages of 9 and 14. It's a very intelligent and very honest audience. I don't make movies to make personal statements. I make movies hoping that they'll make money so I can make more movies. Oh, yeah. So that's his attitude going into this. So with this goal in mind, Bill gets the keys to Walt's office in the summer of 67, which, by the way, had been locked the day he died.
And really?
They weren't allowing people in. Oh, and so he sits at Walt's desk. He goes through the slush pile of scripts. He's looking for that film that would appeal to 9 to 14-year-olds, which also would make some money for the mouse. And he finds Boy, Girl, Car. And he's like, okay, this has broad appeal. I can do something with this. But it now comes down to, okay, so it's a story about a stubborn, small, little car. But what car? And so, but Bill has kind of a genius idea. You know, early one morning, he has a dozen small cars, a couple of Toyotas, a handful of Volvos, an MG, and one pearl white Volkswagen Beetle. And he has them parked outside of the Disney studio commissary. And then he gets himself a cup of coffee and he sits in the patio and watches as the employees come in for the day and they go to get their coffee and their donut. And he wants to see how they interact with the cars.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the guys, they look at the MG and they're checking out, you know, what the features in the Toyotas and that sort of thing. But what Bill noticed consistently is the one car that people just didn't touch, but they petted. Was the Volkswagen.
And because it's the most accessible of the cars. I mean, you and I, Jim, can work on a Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. Well, we could fix that car. Yeah,
you repair the rubber band, then you go. So Bill starts working on whatever this film is going to be. But the problem is, at this point, they're looking for a title. Mm-hmm. And at this point, it's called Beetle Bomb. It's called Wonder Beetle. It's called Thunderbug, the Magic Voxie, and the Runaway Wagon.
Oof, that's a mouthful.
Problem here is that Volkswagen doesn't want to let Disney actually use the real name of the car in their movie.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, mind you, they came around as soon as it was a hit. Yeah. And this is why when you watch the first Herbie movie, you'll hear it called the small car, the Douglas special, the compact car, but they never actually call it what it is, which is a Volkswagen Bug.
Do they use the word Beetle at all in the first film?
No. I mean, that's what's so bizarre.
It's strange. Yeah.
But anyway, they start shooting the racing scenes in the fall of 67 as he casts up the film. And, you know, he's still struggling for a title. It's the summer of 67, which is the summer of love. And so Bill's like, split the difference. It's the Love Bug. So they shoot the live action scenes in the summer of 68 with the cast, Dean Jones, Michelle Lee, Buddy Hackett, David Tomlinson. And as they begin to assemble the footage, it's like, this is something special. This is something good. This could really be a huge hit for the studio. So the PR team is like, okay, so what do we do to really launch this thing big? This is obviously a summer film. It should be, in fact, you know, the thinking was that we want this to be in as many theaters as possible in the summer of 69, you know, literally hit the weekend that the drive-ins open. Because it's a car movie, you know, people will take their cars to go see the car movie. But at the same time, they feel like, well, we got to build it before that. So they put together this idea that they'll actually release the Love Bug to 50 theaters around the country in March of 69, let the word of mouth build, and then a couple of weeks later, around Memorial Day, just as the drive-ins open, they'll flood the country with prints.
Oh, okay. All right.
But in order to have the white-hot heat of people need to be aware of this, they realize it would be great to have something in national magazines in that same window of time that are kind of reminding, keeping the Love Bug front of mind. Mm-hmm. And so this is when they come up with the idea of the most lovable bug contest. They contact VFW dealerships around the Southern California area, and some money had to have changed hands because they got the addresses for everyone who had purchased a VW in Southern California over the past 3 years.
Privacy schmiracy.
There you go.
Exactly.
But it's just the effect of, oh, by the way, you know, if you're not doing anything March 23rd and you want to drive down to Anaheim and put your car in competition for the most lovable bug contest, well, first of all, we'll give you free admission to Disneyland. Second of all, we'll give you a bunch of tickets that you can use when you're in the park that day. And, oh, by the way, if you happen to win the contest, you get a brand new 1969 Volkswagen Bug.
Nice.
They were hoping for 1,200 entrants. They actually got well over 1,000 who turned up. It was a very gray morning in March in 1969, but they competed in four different categories. Best personality, most toy-like, most comical, and most psychedelic. It was the 1960s, Len.
Most psychedelic. I love it.
You can go to YouTube right now, and if you plug in Love Bug Days, you can watch a 12-minute-long professionally shot film that shows you the parking lot, the ex-parking lot at Disneyland filled with these cars. And
oh my God, you're right.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
These cars are hysterical.
Oh, yeah. Well, what gets better is that
the clothes of the people, Jim.
It is such a quintessential late 60s.
Could you just love it when Americans discover drugs? God. All right, go ahead.
Wait till you see some of these cars. Some of them were well past discovering, Len. On each of the four categories for the contest, they picked 25 finalists, and those 100 cars then actually got to parade through Disneyland. They took them in backstage, brought them out onto Town Square, and then rolled them up Main Street around the hub, up Matterhorn Way, and eventually exited the park by to the left of Small World. But what's great is if you watch this film, you can see footage that they shot from the skyway of these things driving through the park. And in the end, Dean Jones himself, the star of The Love Bug, presented to Morton and Barbara Allen of Studio City, California. They got their brand new 1969 Volkswagen Bug and hugely successful PR stunt line. Everything that Disney hoped for happened. The event got covered by Time, Life, Look magazine. TV stations around the country ran footage of this thing. So Herbie opened big and just kept getting bigger. In fact, only Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid sold more tickets in 1969. For a time, it was the second top grossing film in Disney studio history. Only Mary Poppins sold more tickets. So of course, amazing. Company makes a sequel. It released in 1974, Herbie Rides Again, and they do yet another Herbie Day at Disneyland, which this one I'm chasing after, Len, because they took the footage that they took in this one and created an hour-long TV special that was syndicated. And this would be fascinating to watch because they also used this special to hype the literally had evidently opened weeks beforehand, but America Sings, the Bicentennial attraction.
I'll bet somewhere on his 500 DVDs, Tony Baxter has footage of this.
There we go.
By the way, I'm watching this video. Did you see the people in the parade of cars dressed as Beatles with painted shells on their back, like actual Beetle bugs?
Oh, no, I missed that.
If this happened now, Jim, there would be commemorative cupcakes. It decorated like every single one of these cars. This is amazing. Oh, my God, look at the winners. Look at what they're wearing, Jim.
Yeah. Do you need protective glasses to look at these clothes? They're little. The colors do not occur in nature. You have to admit that.
This is beautiful. Oh, we have to watch this. Okay, so the title of the video for everyone, it's called Love Bug Day at Disneyland 1969. It's by a guy named Jim Douglas.
Okay.
Wow.
Of course, when you have two films that do this much business, the original Love Bug and Herbie Rides Again, of course, Imagineering is going to be asked to kick the tires, so to speak, of developing a Love Bug-themed attraction. And they did. There are at least two pieces of concept art that have floated up into the internet. One recreates a scene from Herbie Rides Again, where literally Herbie is driving up a support cable for the Golden Gate and sort of crests the top of that bridge. The other one, and this is the thing that was going to be the big finale of the attraction, Len, and I don't know if you remember the original Love Bug movie where Herbie, in the final race, basically falls apart. He splits in half, so he ends up coming in first and third in the race. So this is what the attraction was going to do. As you were coming up to the finish line, there'd be four people riding in the Herbie-shaped ride vehicle. It would split in half, and then the front of the car would race the back of the car and see who would get the checkered flag.
I'm thinking, Jim, if we do a Radiator Springs holiday layover mm-hmm. with Herbie, it would vault into my top five if that happened. If the car would have to split in half and then finish first and third with the other car coming in second.
That could be cool.
All right.
Interesting thing is that Imagineers take this idea to Disney management and they're like, it's cute. It's not let's spend $30 million to build it cute, but it's cute. By the way, Herbie would eventually make it into a Disney theme park, though. I'm sure you, Len, remember when he went on the backstage tram tour and came to, actually, this was Ernest's friend Vern's house on Residential Street. Herbie was parked in the driveway there, and he would rear up, and he'd flap his doors, and he'd open his hood, and his back tires would spin and create smoke, and windshield wipers would spray water on people who were riding the tram. But it did it for every tram that went by until the day the electrical motors that powered the thing burst into flames. And, you know, a bunch of tourists got some very interesting photos to take home of, you know, Herbie still doing all of the hood opening and, you know, and doors flapping. Only he's on fire, so it looks like he's in agony, like, oh, God, help me! So
wasn't there a remake of the film with
Lindsay Lohan. It came out in 2005. They did try to reboot it after they did three sequels. There was a TV series in 1982. There was a TV movie in 1997 with Bruce Campbell. So, I mean, it's not for lack of trying. But these days, if you're looking for Herbie, you really, particularly Walt Disney World, the place you have to go is the All-Star Movies, where between building 6 and 7, they have that oversized Herbie sort of bisecting the building. But yeah, honestly, folks, if you want an entertaining piece of video, as Len was just mentioning, go seek out this Love Bug Days video. And what a snapshot of what it was like to go to Disneyland.
That's one of the best videos I've seen in a long time. That's fantastic.
12 minutes long.
12 minutes of absolute classic late 1960s fashion. It's incredible.
There we go.
Great job, Jim. This is you were on today, man. This was great.
I'm here all week, folks. Tip your waitresses. Okay. There we go.
All right, folks. That's going to do it for the Disney Dish Show today. Please head on over to disneydish.bandcamp.com, where you'll find exclusive shows never before heard on iTunes. Next week's show, we're going to talk all about the Reedy Creek Improvement District, where it came from and where it's going. You can find more of Jim at jimhillmedia.com and more of me, Len, at touringplans.com. We are produced fabulously by Aaron Adams, who's entering his prize-winning bacon, beef, and veal East Texas chili in the East Texas Gusher Days Chili Cook-Off on Saturday, April 16th, 2022, at the corner of Commerce and Main, starting at 1 p.m. in beautiful downtown Gladewater, Texas. While Aaron's doing that, please go into iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.